Pod. 22 grand. Pod. In the city that sounds
nice. Huh. Hey, man.
Nothing, mate. You all right?
How you doing?
Not bad, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Good stuff.
That's a good garage. Is that a garage?
No, it's my basement. I kind of like get relegated to here and do my podcast.
Nice. The perfect podcast hideout.
Yeah, it's actually pretty good for sound because it's all like low ceiling and everything.
Yeah, man, that's perfect studio space right there.
Make sure the dry is not on it, it's all right.
Yeah. Whereabouts are you?
Just an outside of Manchester.
Oh, nice.
Are you in London?
Yeah, in London, yeah, South London.
Ah, okay. Yeah, is that where you grew up, kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm pretty much still where, because yeah, I grew up in Wandsworth and I'm in Battersea, which is, it's just still South London. I've always been south of the river.
Right.
Still clinging on.
I lived in East London for a bit.
Right.
Didn't venture south too much, but yeah.
That's the thing. It's a divide, isn't it? It's like you're one side or the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I was enjoying your episode on Feels Like Healing.
Oh, nice one, man.
Since like the day, just because my dad passed away when I was 18, and I've got I've got a little boy as well, a 2-year-old. So what you were saying about. Right. Him, your lad asking questions, I just found really interesting because I've not got to that point yet, but I'm kind of looking forward to it really.
I definitely felt it's like I can't remember exactly what I said on that, but like it definitely felt like I got to kind of use it as an excuse to kind of reintroduce, do you know, something that I hadn't, like, and you know, my mum's name that I hadn't really spoken about and that much, so it's actually really nice. It's like kind of reigniting in some way.
Yeah, and it'd be cool when that starts to happen, I think.
Oh, nice, man. How's the first 2 years been?
It's been all right. Yeah, we've actually
relegated to the basement. I see.
It says it all, doesn't it? He's just starting new nursery, so he's not been too happy about going in on the morning, but.
He's literally just started this last week.
Yeah, so he was at another one where he got real settled and then we've moved him, so I don't think he's too happy with us, yeah.
Oh, right, okay, yeah. Fuck, man. Right. It's mad, isn't it? It's mad.
I know, when people ask what it's just like a mix of everything thrown into one, yeah.
And it just goes on and changes and changes. It's like always... just it's life, isn't it? I guess. I mean, it's not being 18 and doing whatever you want, is it?
you suddenly start to appreciate that, don't you?
Yeah. The freedom.
Yeah.
Once had freedom.
Just to get a bit of context and everything, just take it right back, really. Am I right in thinking... you all went to uni together in Brighton, is that right?
Yes. So we did, yeah. We moved there as a band, basically. So we'd started... we started the band in London and kind of... we were all in there, sort of Clapham, Wandsworth. And we started there and then... actually, we probably were a band for, like, nearly 2 years before... or maybe a year... and then Orlando Singer moved to Brighton to study, to do an art degree, which had that moment where it felt like, oh fuck, like this is falling apart. Like, and actually we just kind of quickly all scrambled together and got places at university in Brighton and just moved the whole thing down there. And which actually was, you know, in looking back on it, really helped everything because Brighton was a... we'd kind of had that starting point in London. And actually it was hot, like, although we had kind of gained some kind of thing, you know, maybe we'd get like 30 people to a show or, you know, something like that, which seemed like a big achievement, you know. But So yeah, we spent a while gigging like that, and then actually Brighton was a place where, because it's a small place with and so many venues in such a small area, that it just felt like we could just keep playing all the time, and it just became, it was almost kind of easier to kind of cultivate something, you know. And that's where we got built it into, you know, getting record deal and all that stuff.
Right, okay. But I heard you on the podcast saying you only started playing guitar when you were 16 as well.
Yeah.
Which seems quite late, I guess, but...
I know, yeah. It is, I guess... I don't know why that is. I mean, yeah, Felix had been playing guitar, who was in the band. He actually wasn't in the Maccabees at first. He was in a band with Jack Pignatti. So they had a band called Jack's Basement. And they were like the big band around town. And Felix knew Orlando and introduced me to knew Orlando's brother, actually. And Orlando wanted to start a band. And I had literally just started playing guitar at home. And Fee told him that I might want to, you know, play guitar. I said, do you want to speak to him? And I, you know, put me on a phone call to Orlando, and it within, you know, I think it was like, well, do you want to come to my house tomorrow? So I just went to his house, and literally, yeah, I sat on his bed, and him and our drummer at the time, Rob, they had like rehearsed a few, so I think they had three songs or something. And I sat on the bed and they just played me three songs, you know, and then said, what do you think?
What did you think? Yeah,
I thought, well, I don't remember really thinking that much of it. I wasn't blown away musically by what they were achieving sonically, but I was, I mean I was like, yeah, definitely, let's do it. But I think that was the thing. I was kind of joining as a guitarist, but I knew I wasn't really a guitarist. I didn't know what I was, but I wasn't a very good guitarist.
What about Felix at that time? Was he a bit more developed?
He was better, yeah. He was a good guitarist. And he was in this the band with Jack. And I think it actually got... So we played a bunch of shows where we would be, you know, we would come and support them, or it would be that way around. And something started happening with us where we started gaining, you know, it started becoming a thing. We had some good songs, and I think it got to the point where we were kind of like, oh shit, we're actually on the same level now as Jack's Basement. And then I think there was always a draw. I don't know what happened. I think Jack was kind of, it was kind of always on the cards. It was his show a little bit, and because he went on to do a solo thing. And I don't actually know exactly what happened there, but I know Felix asked me if he could join the Maccabees, and I said, let me think about it. And I made him wait. I mean, I gave it a good few days where I was like, I'm not sure if I want him in the band. But ultimately, I always knew I was going to say, yeah, of course, but it was one of those things, which was, you know, which was great. I mean, and that made it really, and then it became a new thing again, and that was still in London.
Yeah, I think someone asked a question, William Hahn, I think, asked, yeah, if there was like a brotherly rivalry that kind of helped, that made you kind of want to get better kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, it probably did, yeah, with like... the way we played, I think it probably did influence how we play guitars, because there was never, and I think even that in Felix, you know, actually maybe even when he joined the band, I was like, that's what it was. It was like, yeah, you can join the band, but you're not the lead guitarist. even though I knew he was the lead guitarist. And actually, I think the way we played guitars was it, because there was that mentality that no one was the lead. So everyone's, both of our parts were as interesting as each other all the time, and it was never just someone's part on its own, you know, so it was never kind of all chords and just one guitar doing a solo. It was like, if you're doing a solo, I'm doing a fucking solo at the same time. But, you know, so we'd, but neither of us could do solos. So it was just, you know, we'd both be doing these kind of one note patterns or whatever. And that, you know, but yeah, and that all kind of led together. But I think, again, that was something that was, there was a lot of bands kind of doing that at the time. And a lot of things that we were inspired by were, felt like that really, was not about sort of virtuoso playing, but about, is that like kind of like ethic, I guess, like what, stemming from the, you know, the way the Clash played or something, that where it didn't feel like they had to know what they're doing. It was just about the intent that you did it with. But then there was also but like even that early Interpol stuff, where it was just so simple what was being played, but it just sounded so powerful. And I think we took a lot from that, where and the Strokes as well, which actually looking back on it is pretty complicated stuff. I mean, they were better like, but there was also a simplicity to it, you know, like that. Even like the bass player, where it was just like, if you just play one note really consistently and everyone's playing downstrokes and you hold that chord for as long as, you know, you can hold that chord for half of the song, so you only need to know two chords, because so yeah, so we took a lot of that on, I think, as well.
And then in terms of songwriting, I heard you say that Orlando would write the lyrics. Was it up to you guys to write the music, or was it kind of more of a group effort?
It kind of changed. I mean, Orlando was the songwriter, really. You know, he wrote the lyrics, and the concepts really came from him. And I think especially, but there was always a thing of, we worked on the songs as a band, so things would develop for a long time. It was never, I don't think we were ever a band that just kind of had a song and played around it. It was like we'd really delve into verses for months, you know, kind of like changing tiny bits and moving things around, and then keep going, and then kind of find, stumble upon something that led to a chorus thing, and then it would kind of all just kind of like build pathways through things until they became the song. But you know, yeah, but we, you know, Orlando was, he was the one that would come in singing stuff, you know, and actually at those early days, like, I think there was he had, yeah, his take on things just like kind of made us unique, I think, and gave it its own space. And also his voice, like, he had to, like, thinking back on it, like, his voice really stood out,
And then you mentioned Brighton, just because I was reading an article on NME where apparently one venue manager accused you of inciting a riot and actually banned you. And you actually got banned from Brighton venues for a bit.
We actually did. Yeah, I forgot about that. We actually got banned from playing in Brighton at all as a band. The Maccabees were banned from playing in Brighton, which was insane. And also banned from venues. We weren't allowed to go to gigs in the venue. It was, and then the next gig after our ban was lifted, which was like, I think it was a two-week ban maybe or something like that. After it was lifted, we did a gig, and they basically lined the venue with police officers.
Wow.
And absolutely killed the atmosphere of the gig. I mean, it was just like the driest, like, the most sterile, uncomfortable scenario. It was ridiculous. I can't remember exactly what happened, but it was at Concord 2, which is a venue on the seafront, and it was, I think we were at that stage, yeah, where it was, and that was about 600 people, I think. And it was like really like kicking off, like people would be really excited and crowd surfing and that kind of stuff. And I think something happened. Oh, geez, was that the bouncer? Oh, no, that wasn't that one. Something happened where they thought Orlando was trying to get, he was like helping kids crowd surf or something like that. And they decided that it was I don't know. Maybe something did happen I didn't know about it, but we didn't really do anything bad at all. Yeah. It wasn't fair to blame us for. And I don't think anyone even, I don't know. I think the whole thing didn't really make any sense, but.
Yeah, well, I remember we came to watch you around that time when you played in Hull.
Wow, wicked.
And it's a really small venue called Lamp, and it was a similar atmosphere, like people were going bananas. And I think Orlando had to tell people to calm down, so right, yeah. Everyone started going even more mental. But.
Yeah, has the opposite effect. But was that with Fear of Flying supporting? Was that that gig?
Maybe, yeah. I think it might have been, yeah.
Because I remember we did a show in Hull with them. But, yeah.
Well, there's a couple. There's one at Lamp and one at a place called Welly, I think.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The one at Welly I remember because I remember afterwards people were just queuing for the coats.
Right.
And Orlando just came around chatting to everyone, which I thought was cool.
Wicked. Great.
But, yeah.
We always used to love that, just like, actually just hanging out. Well, and at those times it was so exciting to be doing it, you know, to even be in Hull. We would have been excited, you know. It was like everything was an adventure, isn't it? So it was all about getting involved.
Yeah but is that when is touring the best, when you're that age kind of thing, when you're new to it?
I think probably yes, because that was it's hard to ever really match that excitement of doing it all for the first time and get going, you know, coming from growing up in one place to then suddenly visiting everywhere in England, you know, and just staying one night in every place and moving on, and just that, which would have been those early tours where we'd do like 40 shows or something around England in a splitter van, sleeping at people's houses or whatever it was, or having like six people in a one bedroom travel lodge, and like as you wouldn't be able to sustain that for very long, but that moment in time where you're happy with that, where that's like you feel like that's an achievement to have six people in a travel lodge room and everyone just sleeping on the floor, and like the point where that feels like success. And then I guess later on it becomes, everything becomes not as good or not good enough, you know, so you kind of like end up being exhausted by, you don't want to stay, you know, like even sharing rooms, you're like, are we still sharing rooms, man? We've been sharing rooms, because it pretty much was that at the end of our touring. I think we just got to the point where we weren't sharing rooms anymore, but me and Rupert, who's a bass player, we shared bedrooms like for the whole time. And it's like, yeah, you definitely get to that thing where you're like, are we never ever gonna get our own room? It's like weird. Like yeah, and even the show's getting bigger and stuff, it's the same excitement when you first start selling tickets to people. And having that buzz, like you said, in those venues, like it's kind of the same. It just has to get bigger to be able to keep that same level of enjoyment. If you don't keep getting bigger, then if you keep getting bigger, you can just about keep that level of enjoyment going because you're always on that next tier. But then if you're not doing that, it's hard to remain as enthusiastic, I guess. I don't know, maybe that sounds bad, but you couldn't, like, for example, now the idea of touring, like back then when we were 19, it's like, I don't want to do it. It's the point. That's it. It's not for me.
Yeah, once for it to Gary Jarman from the Cribs, he said they kind of benefited from quite a gradual incline.
Yeah.
And I guess, would you say the same for you? I suppose you were quite popular to begin with, or was that not the case?
I think like slowly. No, I think this in the same way. I feel like we didn't, although it did, like it was great and exciting, but I don't think we ever really blew up. And actually, I don't think we ever really did have that moment where it kind of exploded. It was just like, yeah, I think we completely just constantly just sold a few more tickets each time and just and kept going. And right, and actually, we did that for 15 years or whatever it was. To the point where it was, you know, wherever we ended up, it was like it was headlining festivals and you know, the Alexandra Palace shows and stuff, which were just huge things, but it didn't feel, it's like we'd already, you know, even to get to that point where we did 3 Ali Pallies, it's like we'd done 1 Ali Pally, then 2 Ali Pallies, then 3 Ali, you know, it's like, and with Brixton Academy, you know, even all, every step, we basically did every event in England. We did every step of venue. We never skipped anything. So we probably played, yeah, we just played our way up for everything, which is, looking back on it, I mean, that's great. That was great, a great thing. And probably kept us going, you know.
And then in terms of like labels and like management, at what point did that kind of come in? Was that quite quickly?
No, in Brighton that kind of happened really, because we were still when we were playing in Brighton, we'd started to give, I think we made an EP or something like that, that we'd hand out to people, and it had mine and Orlando's phone number on the back, and that was our kind of like effort to try and get people, you know, I don't even know what we were trying to get. I think we were trying to get gigs, but that was it. Yeah, we weren't really chasing managers or record labels. We were chasing gigs. I think that was how we saw it. I don't even think it had even crossed our minds really that yet needed to get a manager. And then we met a promoter called Laura Davidson, who I'd gone down to find her. Someone had told me that she was the promoter in Brighton that you needed to speak to get gigs, and I'd gone down kind of like bigged us up to her, and she'd given us a gig, and then it kind of she put on a few shows for us, and then she's kind of said, well, should I help you with this, and she got involved, and through her we met, she introduced us to John Reed, who's a man who was lived in Brighton at the time, and he had managed like Delamitri and Lightning Seeds and Gil Norton, the Long Pigs. Like he'd had his, you know, he'd done his work in things, and he loved the show. I think he might have even been about to retire at that point. I don't actually know, but he invited us to his house, and we sat down, and he was like, what do you want to do? And we're like, we want to take this as far as it can go. And he was like, cool, let's do it. And we went, and that was our team really. And through that, and I guess his experience, suddenly we had a bit of guidance, and did a couple of singles, I think, with Fierce Panda, which was sorted through John really. And then our introduction to Fiction, which I guess like Jim Chancellor and Alex Close at Fiction at the time came down to a show, and that turned into something. And we signed that record deal. I can't remember exactly the year, but I was probably 19 maybe. And that record deal, I think it was a 4 album deal, can't remember, but anyway, we were on this, we made all of our music with them right up until to the last record.
Is that a bit of a pinch yourself kind of moment then when that happens? Or you've kind of built up to it?
What, when we had
when you signed on like a 4 or 5 album deal?
I think at every point in that deal they could have dropped us. I don't think they were stupid enough to, well, I mean, I don't know how it all works, but they, but um Yeah, it was. I mean, we were. Yeah, we couldn't. I mean, it was so. It was the best feeling in the world, really, to have like. And we were at these. You know, I'd started a course at university in product design, which I was kind of. I quite like the idea of product design, but I didn't really want to do. You know, I kind of saw it as I had the. That gave me a student loan that paid for my rehearsals and meant that I was in the same place as the band. And so actually the pleasure I took in being able to go in and get into my, which actually I kind of did before I needed to do it, but going into university, I don't think I really turned up, to be honest, anyway. I don't think they even knew I was still there. But I made the point of going in and going, I'm not going to come back anymore. I'm out now.
At least you told them.
So but yeah, that was amazing because it gave us that full time focus. We could just do, you know, I think we all just stopped doing what we were doing, and it actually at that time paid for us, you know, we didn't have to work like on anything else, we just worked on the band. And it wasn't, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had enough money to live, and that was it, you know. But I still, like, we were literally on the same, the way we did the whole Maccabees thing, we just were on the same way from that day, basically, that we signed the record deal. We put ourselves on a monthly income and just paid ourselves that throughout the whole thing, so we never kind of like had loads of money or any less money than that. We just always just had enough to get by, and actually that saw us through our whole career, really.
Yeah So you had no like big Guns N' Roses moments or anything?
no I don't know. Yeah, we didn't even like, maybe it was quite clever. I don't know if it was us just not paying enough attention or it was really cleverly managed, but we never kind of went, oh look, we got loads of money. It was always like, you don't have loads of money. And maybe that was just the truth of it. It was like,
keep you humble.
Yeah.
And you mentioned those early recordings, like obviously around that time, you know, like the demos that were put on there, kind of pretty special early times. Was it good to be able to like get those recordings out to fans kind of as and when you wanted?
What with the EP thing I was saying about?
I just remember like those early recordings like on MySpace and stuff, like they became big in themselves before there's any actual official kind of release.
Yeah, which I'd love to actually hear those recordings because I can't remember what ones they would have been. But I think MySpace was the first thing where you sort of saw your plays, right, like sort of tally up and people could comment. Or could you see the plays on MySpace? I can't remember.
Maybe
it was how many friends you had.
That's the one, yeah, top friends.
It was great, yeah, because it just built and built. And actually, yeah, people knew the songs more, and it was that thing of like certain songs just connected in, and then they connected live and it translated back into everything we're doing. So I don't know, yeah, thinking about it, yeah, it was an amazing thing. It really was, to think that the thing that you'd been creating and making was just having. Was just taking on its own life.
And I was reading that Latch Me was kind of like a bit of a breakthrough song and a bit of a viral video as well.
That was such a good song. Yeah, which again was just Orlando, just that was his idea, you know. And it was just exciting, and I think it was people related to that. And I literally go to Latchmere every weekend.
Right.
I take my kid there, we were going because the pandemic was like no one could go swimming or whatever. So when he was really little, so then we started going after they opened it up again, and they had no wave machine, right, for basically for nearly a year. So we were just going there, and it was like it was like, it's the nearest swimming pool, it's good, like, doesn't have the wave machine, but he didn't know it had a wave machine anyway, so it's like, it's all good. And then and then like 2 weeks ago we went and like, and literally out of nowhere just hear the siren come on that they turn on for the wave, and they'd fixed the wave machine and the whole thing, and you just, it was like, actually, I honestly, which is quite sad to say, but I honestly felt like crying, because it was like, it literally, everyone in the swimming pool, they're, everyone's like, and it's like a family session or whatever, where it's like, so it's all families and kids, and everyone's face just lights up, like it's like magic, because because they probably hadn't, because they haven't had it on for so long, so none of these kids have known it was even there. And and it's just, yeah, and my son was just like, I just couldn't believe, like, he just loved it, and it just made me feel like, it's amazing. I was like, on the way back, I was like, do you want, we had a song, my band had a song about a wave machine, do you want to listen to it? He's like, nah. Okay, you sure you don't want to listen to it? It's about the wave machine at me. Nah. Okay, all right, I won't play that. That's the end of that.
Yeah, I've heard kids can be a bit brutal about
yeah.
Like, even when I'm, when he was watching Postman Pat and stuff, my lad, he'll start singing the theme tune, and if I join in, he's,
oh yeah, happy. yeah you're not allowed to join in. we get told that in the class, like, you know, that's a main thing. It's like when there's a song on that, sometimes it's like, no, don't sing, and we just have to sit in the car just silent. Well, he just enjoys the song. It's really hard not to sing when you're being told not to sing and you want it. Yeah.
Then, yeah, you mentioned kind of like maybe like building a scene in Brighton. Did he feel part of a scene early on? Oh, not really.
I think we always felt like we were surrounded by, we knew lots of people that had bands or knew of bands, but I think we did always feel like we were kind of on our own in some way, even whether we wanted to be or not, I don't know, but we didn't, yeah, there were people we would have played with more and stuff, but it didn't feel like, it felt like we'd sort of hear about scenes and it, we weren't really as locked in as other people might have been with certain things, but there was always a community to it, and there was, and anyone that was really good, we made sure we were, you know, we became friends really. It was kind of that thing, you know, if you liked a band, you'd wait around for them to finish and talk to them. But so I guess through that way, and it depends, you know, what time, and that's, it just, even thinking like Mystery Jets and Jamie T, and at that kind of time, for some reason I think remembering Good Shoes as a band of that, who were wicked,
incredibly hard bands to track down, by the way.
Really? What now?
Yeah, can't get in touch with anyone.
I heard Reese, the singer, was a lifeguard.
Really?
Yeah.
At Latchmere?
Not at Latchmere. I've been looking for him. But he's not, no, I don't know where, I mean, whether he is or not. Maybe that was quite a long time ago, but...
Oh, they had some great songs.
Yeah, that first album was wicked.
Yeah, real good.
Yeah, really good band.
Yeah, I saw you went on touring around America with Block Party fairly early on.
Yeah, that was early on, that first American tour. Again, that was it. Maybe that was like just after our first album had come out, and... again, yeah, that was an incredible experience that you can't really, again, you can't really match, like, touring America after that. It was so exciting that it couldn't, that thing of just, like, arriving in New York and seeing, you know, and seeing the yellow taxis and smoke coming out of the drains, and, like, it just felt like it was just amazing. And we did some wicked, like, we played, like, a casino in Las Vegas, and there was a bunch of really amazing moments on that tour. We had a bus crash, our first van crash. We hit a hit a deer in the we were driving through Kansas, I think, kind of felt middle of nowhere, and it was fast, like we were doing probably like full on whatever, and basically a deer just stepped out into the road. Looked, Felix was sitting in front actually next to the driver, and he remembers it looked like the deer looked him straight in the eyes, and then we hit the deer head on.
Wow.
And the deer just like must have flew off the van, kind of swerved and just about narrowly avoided coming off the side where it's like kind of like on a not a cliff but like a big sort of deserty hill, and pulled over, and the front of the van was like completely caved in. With everyone was fine, but you know, just like dripping with blood, and it was actually it was like a silver van, and the whole side of it was just red with blood from the deer where it like just, and in the middle of the night, and we were just literally all got out the van. This is the first time any of us had been to America on tour, and we were all young looking back on it. Even our tour manager was a DJ from a club in Brighton that we'd asked to tour manage us. So it was all new to all of us. And we ended up having to push this van just in the pitch black until we found a petrol station somewhere, and found a petrol station. The people like in the petrol station couldn't understand our accents and thought we were the strangest people they'd ever seen. And it was all just, that was quite a mad experience, actually.
Yeah, that's mad. I saw you, did you have like an accident backstage once playing cricket or something as well?
Cricket, did I? Yeah, maybe I did.
Something like you did your back in before a gig,
yeah,
but you
managed to,
or something.
Yeah, I did.
From Berlin to Felix or something.
Where did you hear that?
I just like searched on NME and it's like a random article saying it's like a cricket incident.
A cricket incident. Yeah, I mean, that sounds about right. Yeah, I did. And I pulled a muscle in my back and I couldn't move. And it was literally before the show, it was a festival somewhere. The festival had like where they always have these like massage like things that you can book, like, and they had a acupuncture person, and they put, which I'd never done before, and they put needles in my head, put a few needles in my head, and it sorted out.
Nice. Good festival experience.
Yeah.
He was mad for cricket, it's Felix's.
Felix, yeah. That's his thing.
Yeah, you into it? I'm not bothered.
Not really. I mean, no, I'm not bothered, but I'm not to the same degree.
Yeah, I mean he's.
I mean he's
he's fully, next level, yeah.
Fully blown cricket person, right?
You're more known for the cricket these days, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. Moved on from music. Got bigger things to deal with.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. And then, yeah, just want to talk about recording the first album, like doing it with Stephen Street, obviously, like, prolific producer. What was that like for an experience as, like, a young musician?
Yeah, I think to immediately, that it was an amazing experience, actually, with Stephen, and we did it at a beautiful studio, Olympic Studios, that's gone now, was in Barnes. But that was a real sort of like, that was really where we realised we'd signed to a major label, because the studio had like, you could go to the canteen and have whatever you wanted for lunch and stuff. But, you know, Stephen was just such a trusted, we loved, obviously, as everyone does, love the records that he's made. And he was just so such a trusted person. And there was never, it was just, you know, what he did sounded great. And there was never a question mark over anything. It was just a kind of seamless process of like, we had the songs, this is how we played them. And he translated that for us. And so actually, so that was a really, really good experience, you know. And I think also, you know, he probably lifted it to a level where we could have made kind of, I think we definitely could have made a lo-fi record somehow, and maybe it wouldn't have translated as well. And so actually, whatever decisions were made, then it was a good one. And we did a bunch of songs with Ben Hillier, who was in a studio in London Bridge called The Pool, which was looked like an empty swimming pool, which again, yeah, we did sort of the other side of the record a little bit. So we did like Toothpaste Kisses and stuff with him, where we did slightly weirder stuff. He had a kind of unique approach to recording. And but you know, that whole thing was just kind of framed with, I don't think we really, it was before we understood anything about recording, or, you know, I think we went into making that record as a band who didn't, we didn't have a guitar pedal between us. There wasn't a guitar pedal. We didn't have any distortions, any reverbs. We just literally plugged into amps, and that by the time we made the record. So it was so basic. And then probably from that experience kind of like started to maybe expand and go, actually, maybe it would be good to have a distortion pedal or something for, but that's the beauty of it, man. Like in terms of, I love that idea in producing records, that the band don't have to have any, because now it's much more difficult, I find, because not necessarily more difficult, but everyone has to a degree this thing of being a record producer, because everyone can record on their laptops and everyone understands things, and computers have everything essentially that a studio has built into them as plugins and stuff, so you can kind of, everyone has a grasp of a compressor and blah, 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 like being able to record stuff. And actually at that time it was like, it was a really beautiful thing to go into the studio as a band, and none of us have any idea what anything did or how anything was really recorded, and just kind of trusted in the process and focused on playing, you know. And that is something that I imagine it just feels more rare, really, the idea of being as naive as we were at that time. But it definitely, it, you know, I think it was a, it made, it made it a good experience, I think.
So you kind of use the guidance from those producers in terms of like what pedals you should be going for, what kind of sound you should be going for, kind of thing?
A little bit, yeah. I think we probably just, I don't know, I feel like a lot of that record was just translated what we were, translated what we did, but well. And I think just coming out of that, I think it probably just sparked, but as any band, like you start to learn these things, you know. So you, every time you go back into the studio, you know a bit more about what you want or how you want things, and it actually it probably makes things more difficult, because suddenly everyone's got an opinion on stuff of this, or actually that's too loud, or that's like, this isn't how I want it to sound. Whereas back then it wasn't, we didn't have any of that. You know, we were just like, yeah, it sounds amazing. Because it's like, because of course it did, because it sounded better than the, you know, we'd never heard it sound, you know? So it's like, but whereas like later on, you know, especially if I compare that to like the last record, it's like everyone's attention to detail is so, you know, hyper sensitive or whatever, that, you know, that, and there's so much detail and nuance in everything, and that it becomes a different thing. So when I look back on that first record, it just seems beautifully plain, you know.
I read that it actually leaked a bit of the album.
Maybe it did. Something that was around the time where people had started to be scared that people were stealing albums online and sharing them and they wouldn't buy them anymore. But I can't remember that exactly, but I do remember the thing on the second album where we were jumping forward a bit, but we would we had copies that we were given, the first copies of the album printed, and that was even more like hypersensitive to things being leaked, because if someone got a copy it was online and then everyone would steal it and no one would buy it. And our drummer had one, we had one copy each, and he lost his bag on the tour. He left it in the dressing room and it had the album in it, and it had the CD, and then like a few days later or something like that, there was a thing from the record label, you know, the album's been leaked, it's online everywhere. And we were sort of sitting there, and we were sitting in the tour bus, and everyone's looking at him like, that's your bag. That's your bag that you lost. That's the whole thing ruined because of that. But whether it was or not, which is funny, isn't it? That's a different thing now, isn't it? Leaking out. Does that still happen? I don't know. How would people... Do people bother with that stuff? I don't think they do bother.
No, because that's where it's all going anyway, isn't it?
It's going to be there, yeah. Just wait a few days.
Plus a few adverts.
You're going to get it free, yeah.
Yeah, like going into the second album with Grammy Award winning producer Marcus Dravs, like how did that compare to the first album? Obviously, like you're saying, you're picking up more knowledge as you go along, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think Marcus had just done the Arcade Fire records, and which was a huge thing for us. And we'd spent a long time writing that record. It was a different record because, like with that first album, you make everything while you're still playing shows, really. So you're kind of in between shows, you're writing songs and then you're playing songs and developing it. So actually, by the time we were making the record, there was no pressure building up to making it because we'd already done it. You know, it already existed. And this time, I think we'd spent a year at least, if not more, in the rehearsal room in Brighton for the first, and that was the first time we'd had no shows for a long time, and we just literally stared at each other and tried to write the album from beginning to end, you know, and in it complete form, which was, I guess, how we always did stuff, which was completely complete everything, you know. We didn't leave stuff for guesswork. And actually, yeah, Marcus was an amazing person at bringing that all together. He's very much, actually, at that time, looking at it at that time, it's like, you do need that. Opinions start to, by a second album, different people got different opinions, it becomes different things, there's more songs flying about, there's more songs people don't agree on, or someone wants it one way, another person another. And I think Marcus was actually the perfect person to kind of put in the room as a boss, and when he kind of, sometimes you need that, and when he made a decision or pointed it in one direction, you couldn't really argue with it. So it was, which is something, you know, like if we were allowed to debate everything and no one kind of said, you know, no, this is the way to go, this is where we should go, then it then things could be more difficult. But actually, yeah, he managed that one well, because we got through it and we were all, you know, and we were really pleased with that record, and it elevated the band again, not into like stratospheric, but it did give us a lift, and it was a great record. And so yeah, it was a good process, and we made it through, like, you know, we got to explore a bit. We did part of it in Liverpool. We did track it all in Elevator Studios in Liverpool. Then we went to, and then we did a bunch of it in Paris. We stayed in the house in Paris, the whole band, and walked to the studio each day. And then we finished it in a place called Hook End Manor, which was like this big kind of country estate house in near Reading that was that had a studio in it, and that's now actually really weird. It was always like had all these stories of being haunted. Like it felt terrifying. Like it was a scary old manor house, you know, and it always we always felt scared being there at night because it was a scary place. And then actually not that long ago I found it had been empty for a while, and actually I don't know exactly the story of who owned it, but it was basically left, it was just left derelict, like they'd kind of fled it. I don't know what the fuck happened, but they left. So there's videos of people going to like, what's it called, where you go, like going with a camera and like breaking in to the derelict
right, yeah,
recording studio and going around and like filming all these rooms that have been empty and for years and years. It's like, it was really strange because it must have been like a, it felt like there was like a family living there and all that stuff at the time. And then it's just, it's mad. And actually, in the video, which is on YouTube, of this guy breaking into it and looking around it, there's like, he goes into the basement of it, and there's, in the basement, there's a gravestone, a child's gravestone.
Whoa, yeah, that is.
I mean, so yeah, that's where we finished the album.
Oh, okay, did it add something to the album, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know, there's some sort of haunting in it, but yeah, no, it was good process.
And then yeah, the third album was in, is it Rockfield, is that,
yeah, we started that in Rockfield, yeah,
Oasis and Stone Roses, is that the same one? I think
it was, yeah, Oasis had made a record there, Stone Roses, Charlatans, like it's an amazing place, yeah. It's still going at the moment. And it's, proper residential studio. It takes you away from everything. You can't even really get into town that easy. So it's just sort of all, you know, and there's like horses and all that stuff.
yeah, I saw a thing with Noel Gallagher where he said he set up halfway on the wall to record Wonderwall or something there. Or something.
Oh yeah, that is, yeah. There's loads of stories like that, and there was a fight. You know, Liam smashed Noel's guitar there or something like that.
Yeah.
That's a sort of famous story from there. but it has a lot of history, that place.
Mm. And then yeah, recording that with Tim Goldsworthy, obviously well known for his DFA stuff and recording the likes of the Rapture. Was he like noticeably? I don't know, is it techniques noticeably different in any way?
We started the record with Tim Goldsworthy and Bruno Ellingham, so we sort of tracked it there. But ultimately, we weren't totally happy with the results of it. So when we came back, so it was all beautiful and rosy when we were in thingy, but listening to it back in our, back in London or Brighton, wherever. I think we might have gone back to London by that point, but it wasn't what we wanted it to be, and we'd spent a long time again writing that record, and so it kind of became, I mean, actually for me that was the kind of entrance into taking over production duties really on stuff, because it wasn't right, and it was like, how the fuck are we going to fix this in, and we had a time limit, you know, there was like, it was supposed to be delivering it in a certain time, and it was just, yeah, I kind of literally just got the files back off them and just went into like working 12 hours a day trying to restore the record to how I/we wanted it to sound, which was a kind of mad process, but it worked out, because we were really happy. We got it to a place we wanted it to be. Again, it's that thing of like becoming, it's not that simple of like just letting someone else do what they want to do with it. It was like, no, it's not supposed to go like that. but then actually that record was again probably our most successful record that record led on to lots of stuff for us, and the shows got bigger and bigger, the I think we had, that was the one Mercury nominated, and we won Ivan Novello, and a bunch of stuff. I think we had Enemy Best Album. Anyway, I don't know, but it had, that was the first one where it was probably, what's it called, critically acclaimed.
You're right. Okay,
it was, yeah, maybe our first critically acclaimed album.
Yeah, it's funny because I was reading an interview where a few of you saying that the label were actually worried about the album, that it was going to be a bit of a flop because it was a bit experimental,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah. Well, it kind of, it was, you know, it was a bit, and it definitely, the demos and stuff were heading that way. And we had, that was the first one where we'd been writing more with computers, so we didn't do it like the second record where we were just in a room staring at each other. We wrote individually on laptops and then kind of collaborated on the files, you know, and just kind of go like, right, Land, come to mine, or I go to Land, or Sam, drummer, and Felix do something, and then we kind of kept passing stuff around. But yeah, I think the label were maybe worried about it. I don't know, really. I mean, it's, you know, it came together.
Yeah. And you only missed out on a number one because of Bruno Mars, Ed Sheeran and Adele, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah. Which was, didn't feel like, I think was at that point we're like, number four was pretty good. That was like, we were very happy with that.
Yeah.
And we'd had, also our albums chart-wise had kept going up because it was like, Colour It In was like, I'm going to guess, but was 24 or something like that. And then Wall of Arms was like 15. And then it was like, and then that was four. So we were really happy with that. Yeah,
just with the last album, I was reading an interview where I think you said if the first album would have been that difficult to make, you'd have probably given up at that point or something.
if what song? The first album?
Yeah, if it had been as difficult as the last album, you'd have probably given up straight away.
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, that was... Yeah, because by then we'd, I think, given to the Wild, we'd toured the most extensively we'd toured. And probably got to hit that kind of exhaustion of being on the road, and then we'd done so much, I think, by that point. Then writing that record was a tougher one. We'd got a studio in Elephant Castle by that point that we had, so we had our own space. Maybe the monotony of it just became difficult, you know, the songs weren't coming as easy, songs were kind of like half songs for way too long, so that point where you've got like so many songs that were like half finished, and again disagreement on how things should be or how what we should be trying to do. And actually that was one that racked up, the demos racked up to 100 or something. It was maybe above 100 at one point, files that we had that we could kind of go, this is where we're up to, let's listen. And it was like 100 bits of music that made no sense whatsoever. So actually getting that to the point where it became a cohesive, whatever it was, 10 or 12 song album was a challenge, and I think definitely took its toll, it had its moments, but there were some great songs that came out of that. And we had our own studio, so we made it in our own studio. There was something nice about being at home and being not being away, which was intentional. We wanted to do stuff like that. And there was, I mean, for me, it was like I enjoyed that process because producing it was like, you know, I was kind of like getting to sort of live out both sides of it, really, which is, you know, was the two things I wanted to do, really, which was producing and being in the band. And but they're also two things that are quite, it's a difficult job, and it's also why a lot of the time, why there's that thing of like people could get outside, you know, like outside external people to sort of balance dynamics and stuff. But you know, it was, that record was again the most successful. I mean, the record went to number one, and it was like led on to the biggest shows we'd done to date, and we started touring again, you know. And I think by the time we were touring that record, it was, we were kind of like, there's a big break coming up. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if there's, yeah, there's going to be a serious amount of years off after this. but yeah, there we go.
Yeah, is that the thing about having your own studio? Is like, you just, you've got the ability just to go wild. There's no, it's hard to know when to stop, maybe.
Yeah, that's definitely, yeah, there was no restraint. There was no, we didn't have anyone sort of forcing us, although the label were kind of on top of it, there was no one giving us deadlines. So it, and we were kind of, I guess, educated enough to know what it's, for it to be our thing, you know. It wasn't, there was no one was our boss really. It was like kind of, well this is what we want to do, so we'll do it this way. And actually that, you know, probably didn't work in our favour in terms of cabin fever, you know. And I don't know, maybe when you spent that much time together, it becomes the, maybe there's a thing of, you know, it's like your age and like we probably all come into that age in life where we're kind of like thinking, oh, is this, is my life locked in forever in this exact scenario, with my diary being ruled by everyone else's and every day being affected by this exact scenario, you know? And I think, maybe you just, maybe that there's a natural pull, I think, at that point with any band, where you kind of either reconfigure so it works for everyone, or, you know, or it just becomes a really difficult thing to do.
Obviously, listening to you talk about your song Silence on the other podcast, was that quite quite a big moment for you on the album? Was that the first song that you'd sung on an album?
It was the first song I'd sung, yeah, because I guess I'd written bits, but it'd always sort of been folded in, which was, yeah, been kind of folded into other songs. And that one, yeah, was the first time it felt like I should sing it, really. And which was I mean, amazing. And I felt very, you know, very supported by the band, and like, and even actually in the vocal and the song, it's like Orlando's singing, I'm singing, but Orlando's kind of doing this, like he's singing it with me, but in a kind of ghostly echo behind my voice, which, you know, which helps out. and it felt right to have that on there. And
yeah, I thought it was really powerful, like, you know, the thing you recorded from, is it your therapist? That's where you'll find me. Yeah, I thought it was really quite really cool how you'd included it, and like really quite powerful. Yeah.
Oh, nice one, man. Yeah, I always, like, that was always, because I listened back to it at some point, and I realised how quiet that was in the mix, that the voicemail is so, it's like, you really got to listen. But that, maybe that's the, you know, that's kind of where we were at as well, with making, like, everything had like kind of like undercurrents and hidden things and, you know, subtle, like, things that point in a certain direction. And there's a lot of subtlety in everything we were doing then, that wasn't how we were as a band at the start, because at the start it was all about, like, it was just bold strokes, you know, bold theme, bold guitars, like, the excitement of the drum and bass parts that was just kind of get things moving. And actually the band that it sort of became was this much more like, yeah, much more thought out, and which is great, but you know, actually thinking about it, they're really far apart, those first and last records.
And then he obviously, like you mentioned, coming to a decision kind of thing, like, you know, you announce a farewell tour, like how, I don't know, how easy was it to come to that decision as a band?
It was going to happen. It was like, well, it's not going to be able to carry on. So we were kind of like, let's hold it together and see it off properly. You know, if we're going to end it, let's at least give the band the kind of, give it what it deserves, you know, because it was like, out of respect for it, was like all of our lives, you know, that we'd put into it, and it literally had been our, you know, we lived and breathed it, you know, from 16 for me. So it was everything to me. I put everything into that band, and so I think out of, and so did everyone else, and actually we didn't want it to just end in that kind of way that it just sort of fell apart, and we're like, it just felt too much, so we kind of found this ground where it was like, well, let's just pull everything together and end it properly then, if we're going to do it, like, let's not kind of do it in half measure, and so yeah, so did it, which was like a really emotional time, actually, thinking about it, to actually just end the whole thing and to play a last show that's like, that's the last time we're going to stand and do this. And you can really see you can like flash before your eyes, like essentially your whole life, you know, like your whole adult life of like from this point to that point. And, but I'm really glad we did it like that, because it would feel weird to think about it if we hadn't have ended, you know, if it just kind of lingered on in a way. So it was a really amazing way to do it, but full of emotions, like so many different emotions the whole time, and like, you know, also just doing those shows and being like, having moments where you're like, just feel like so sad that you're like, this is what I want to do, and we've got to this point, and this is what we've all worked for, and now that we're not going to do it anymore. And so that was, but then also like other emotions of like, do you know what, I feel like I want to move on as well, and this is a good, like, you know, life has another path now, you know. And essentially it has, you know, like my life has dramatically, you know, changed since that point, and there's just things that would never have happened, you know, without that happening. And I think that's the same, even talking about Felix's whole thing with his like life and like cricket and stuff, and that's become such a force of that thing. It's just like things that just wouldn't have happened without had the band sort of not ended and forced people to sort of move, do different things.
Yeah, I think I saw a quote from Felix where he said, you know, it's good that you were able to walk away at your peak. Kind of, there's something good about that.
And that as well, yeah. That was as well, like, a pretty amazing. Yeah, to do that whole rise throughout the whole thing, not kind of make a dud record, not fall off, and constantly be getting more, just edging to being more successful. Yeah, and then leaving at the highest point, yeah. Which is yeah, we definitely did that.
Yeah.
It was good.
And then, yeah, we'll just talk about what you've been up to since. Obviously, working with the likes of Jamie T on his album. It's just interesting because I read that Jamie T had worked with like Miles Kane and Lana Del Rey songwriting. It's a kind of a bit of a community of you guys who get together kind of thing.
not like that really, but... So, I mean, Jamie worked on, he made Miles Kane. I actually recently been working with Miles, so I guess it feels like that. But then Jamie had written some of Miles Kane's record with him. But I think it's all kind of based on sort of hanging around at someone's house, you know, as well. It's not... But, yeah, the Jamie record was something... Actually, I remembered only recently that the first conversation I had with him about it was at the last Alexandra Palace show. And he was like, he on that day of the show, I think he played a song with us. And we were at soundcheck, he was like, we need to have a chat about production. And I was kind of like, so he's kind of like, you know, it was the seed was sown really from that was the next record to make. You know, took a while to get to it, but yeah, that was a process. I mean, which was an absolute dream record for me to make. I mean, Jamie was always the kind of, for me, the most exciting thing and one of the best things that came out of that early 2000s thing. And all those his early records had, I felt, soundtracked my time, even through the Maccabees. You know, that was my thing. You know, my jam.
Pretty sure I saw you guys playing together in Sheffield, in like at one point. I think on some tour.
Yeah. We did a tour together. Was that Panic Prevention on the first album?
It'd have been 2006 or 2007, I think. Yeah,
which were mad exciting shows, those.
Yeah, it's great.
It was just, God, yeah, that was really amazing. Was that, where was that? Leadmill?
Plug, I think.
Right.
Sheffield Plug, yeah.
Right. You got a good memory.
yeah, just like, I've been chatting to my mates about this stuff recently, and they kind of remind me of stuff that's happened, yeah.
Right,
yeah, some memorable stuff like that. Night was actually funny because our mate, who's a bassist in my whole band, he managed to get backstage somehow that night.
Right,
picked up a guitar and started playing Wonderwall badly to everyone.
Right, really? Okay.
So that's why it sticks out a little bit.
Right,
well.
Yeah. Nice. I mean, it sounds like that might have happened. Yeah.
Yeah. How satisfying is it then, as a producer, when, you know, Jamie's album goes to number one, kind of thing?
Oh, it's amazing, man, because that again, that's just like a record. In the same way that Marks to Prove It was, they're kind of that and this Jamie record have been, in lots of ways, like bigger than what making a record is. You know, they're not neither of those records were the simple kind of make a record thing. It was like they involve so many aspects of, like, you know, there's a kind of life behind it, and the time is, neither felt like a job, a neat job, you know. They're just a big part of, they feel to me both like a big chunk of life. And so the fact that record going to number one for Jamie and for me is just like, I think it's just an amazing, it was just an amazing way to be able to see that, you know, reach that, yeah, come out, you know, and like vindicate the work a bit. I guess it's weird, isn't it, because you don't think, you know, whether it really means anything, but it's a nice thing, isn't it, number one album, because it's like an understandable thing. It's like a common language, isn't it? It's like a number one album, it's just very easy to understand this. Oh, that's quite good. Do you know what I mean? Like, whereas you're like, but like, whatever, you know.
No, I've been enjoying that this week, yeah.
Nice, yeah, really, really amazing. That's been an amazing experience making that record.
And then, yeah, obviously saw you playing Glastonbury with him. Like you say, he played with you guys in the past as well. So is that kind of just like a natural thing to celebrate the album type of thing?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think we'd spent so much time together that it just felt on music that it felt. Yeah, he just said, "Do you want to come and play?" And I was like, "Yeah." I think he was. There's a running joke that he didn't. He said, "Do you want to come and play guitar?" And then when he turned up to his rehearsals, there was a microphone for me. And he was like, why is there a microphone for him? And he's like, and he's told him that I requested it. And he's like, I didn't say sing, I said guitar. And he's like, so behind my back, you're organizing that you've got, you know, suddenly you're singing. I didn't ask you to sing. But yeah, I mean, the Glastonbury thing was just insane. I mean, absolutely insane to see. Because I think Jamie's music, like we're talking about with how we maybe had that to a degree as the Maccabees, but Jamie's crowds are just at another level. And, you know, those songs, the early songs, just with so many lines and so many lyrics that just people just live and breathe for, you know. And to see that in a room when you put everyone there, and especially at Glastonbury when there's like, whatever, it's 10,000 people just absolutely losing it. It is just the whole thing, taken back by the whole thing, really.
Was it on the same time as Paul McCartney as well?
Yes, same time, yeah.
So well,
two very different shows.
Cheers for your time, mate. I'll just
pleasure, just
finish on two... Well, actually, talk about a new project as well with Felix and another one of your brothers, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it 86 TVs?
Yeah, we've been working on that band, yeah, for a few years, really. And actually recently just finished making. We actually went a bit overboard and recorded a 20-track album.
Right.
That was... partly off the back of the pandemic, I think we've got a space that we worked in during when it was all kind of lockdown stuff, and we just had, you know, just kept working on stuff and actually we worked with Stephen Street.
Oh, right. Okay.
So he came in and helped us record, and so that's, it's been a long ongoing thing that's pretty much, we're going to start putting out some music fairly soon and work out how to do it. Yeah,
excellent.
Try and avoid spending months in a splitter van, you know.
So what made you want to get Stephen Street involved instead of producing it yourself?
Well, it was kind of something we did together, you know. It's kind of ended up being a bit of both, but we needed, again, that scenario of just needing, like, just realising that actually we need someone to come in and be the figure, you know, that just makes shit happen. And again, like, we trust Stephen, you know, and he's just a great person to have in the room. And so that just made it, yeah. There was just some sort of nice synchronicity to it as well, to have him involved. But yeah, so that hopefully, yeah, end of the year, we should be putting some music out and working it all out.
You planning to play live and stuff, obviously?
Yeah.
You've already played a couple of gigs, have you?
We did one show to just start it up, but it's just like, it's a different thing, I think, starting a band. Well, of course it is a different thing starting a band, and we've just done it. Everyone else is, we've all got other stuff going on as well, so it's like finding the space and time to do it. But we, you know, this we spent a long time working on the songs and developing kind of how the band is and finding the sound of it. And I think there's something about it that's like, which is quite nice to feel like, even without really intending to do that, it's like the natural thing of, like, there's just such a natural draw to having a band, because that's probably the only thing we know, you know, we've spent our lives like that, that it's like, it's kind of come naturally, that it's like we've made another band. And before you kind of look up, you're like, oh shit, I started a band again.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask people, like, you know, obviously you're involved with producing bands now, like, how would you imagine it would be different now if the Maccabees were starting out? Like, what challenges do you think you'd face?
I think it's a lot harder for bands. I think there's less, even that story like we were talking about earlier, where we got given enough money to have a wage, you know, so we didn't work on could not work other jobs. You know, I feel like that. I'm not even sure if that story is very, especially between a band, a five people band. I feel like you get a record deal now, but you're still working in the shop. Like, I think I'm pretty sure that's closer to where it's at the moment. So, and that, and thinking about it, you know, that was genuinely, you kind of need that as well. You need the freedom. You need, like, if you're kind of on a path to doing something, you need kind of the full commitment into it and time and stuff at a young age. And so that probably makes it a lot harder, because people have to make decisions that are probably, and sometimes probably like smart decisions of like, this is not going to work out for me being in a band, because like, whereas I guess if there's a bit more investment in it, you can kind of go, actually fine, I'll put everything into it. But it's not that easy, is it, if you can't, you know. So is it, yeah, it's, I think it is a harder time, but then there's probably lots of other benefits as well. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, from what people have said, yeah, like you mentioned earlier, you've basically got a studio on your laptop.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just monetizing it where it becomes hard.
Yeah, and but that thing of studio, laptop studio thing, it kind of works against bands really, because people work as solo things, and actually the expense, which we found out doing this band, really trying to pay, you know, trying to places like storing your gear is expensive, like rehearsing is expensive, being in a rehearsal room each day, it's like, especially in London, I mean, it's like, I feel like we used to pay like, what was it, like 20 quid for rehearsal rooms, and now it's like, you go to a rehearsal room, it's like 120 quid a day, and you're like, what? But then that's the thing, yeah, so we would like, where we would have like just spent all our time in rehearsal rooms slowly developing as a group between the dynamic of people, now it's like there is a draw to go and, oh, why don't I just do it all on my computer by myself, you come around my house, and then you develop it that way, because it's cheaper, it makes, you know, you get to a recorded product quicker, you don't have to develop in that way. Also, there's kind of shortcuts to a lot of that, and you know, and I can see why that maybe makes more sense, that like, than, because doing a band is the long-winded way around it now.
No, yeah, it's interesting.
So it kind of cuts out things, but it makes way for a different style of music, and you know, so
yeah,
don't know, man.
No, it's a difficult one. Yeah, yeah. And then just to finish on, like, is there a high point from your time in the Maccabees, and is there anything you do differently?
The high point. That's really hard. The high point, because I genuinely just feel like it was all dotted with high points, and that was, and nothing was like a, nothing, you know, we never kind of had that, the best time of our career. It was always just bits here and there, and there was always enough to keep it, to keep everything going, you know, get something new came. So yeah, I don't really have a specific high point. But ending it probably was, as well as that's like mixed emotions. I mean, that was the highest point of it, to end that last show. And actually, it probably was the most euphoric a room had been for us, you know, to feel that in the room. It was madly emotional, actually. Like, loads of people crying everywhere and stuff. Like, man, we literally after the gig, we like lots. Closed the dressing room door or whatever, and we were just all in tears for quite a long time. I think everyone was waiting outside the dressing room, like, it was just so much in that room, like, so much, just like everything. I don't know, yeah, it's hard to like, there's so much in those moments, like, so I don't know, that sounds, it's sort of quite sort of sad, but as well, but anyway, and then what was the other one?
The other one was,
yeah, oh, would I do it different?
Yeah, what would you do differently? If anything, yeah.
I'm actually, I also just, I feel genuinely like proud of how we did it and the way we did things and the way we kind of like, the way we treated other people, the way our whole way through our career as a band. And so actually, no, not really. I don't think I would do stuff differently. I feel like proud that we did it and got through it, and I'm happy with that.